though, when I was preparing the talk, tonight's talk, it was coming out a little long, so I didn't know if it would fit after service, so that's why no service. So that's how that went. So tonight I thought we'd continue our journey through this early Buddhist teaching called the Seven Factors of Enlightenment. Some very clever people have the little sheet from last time. Wow. Seven Factors of Enlightenment, or sometimes called the Seven Factors of Awakening. I learned it as the Seven Factors of Enlightenment. It's interesting, like a word, you know? Does a word matter? Seems like a word matters. Enlightenment or awakening. And I noticed my preference is leaning towards awakening between these two. Sort of a coming to see the process of life as pretty much all process. It might be life is pretty much all process. And enlightenment sounds like kind of a state, like a state of being, enlightenment. Before you were not enlightened and then you are enlightened. And there's like no backsliding or something. Like a state change. Kind of like water, it's the same person, I suppose, an enlightened person or a not enlightened person, but maybe it's like a state change, the way we think about it. Kind of like water, you know. Water in its liquid form looks really different from water as a gas. It really looks different and feels different from steam. That's the same thing, right? It's the same molecule. So it's possible that that's the case, and it seems like we have exemplars in human history and all the cultures of really exceptional people. So maybe there are enlightened people. It's possible. But I think on the whole, whether or not there's such a thing or like a state called enlightenment, it's healthier for us probably and more skillful to let go of the idea that there could be a state. Any state at all. Or a plane of consciousness, or a higher or a lower something. To me, it's more helpful to think in terms of process, and then awakening as a process. Awakening is the process of waking up. There is a change implied. It's different being sleepy. You know, being sleepy is different from being wide awake. Being really present, but there's kind of a continuity there, or sort of some gradations, perhaps, some processes happening in the process of waking up and falling asleep. And we don't have to feel so bad when we fall asleep again, because we know we'll wake up again. So, as most helpful in this process of awakening, the Buddha suggests that there are seven mental factors that we should focus on, practice with, bring to light, you know, illuminate, give energy and attention to, these seven factors. We don't need to manufacture them, though, because they're all already there, to some extent, in the human life, in the human heart. And so, last week we talked about mindfulness as the first factor. And tonight we're talking about the second mental factor that furthers this process of awakening. And what's interesting about this factor is it's all about the question of what furthers the process of awakening and what hinders the process of awakening. So the second factor is discernment, discerning which actions of body, speech, and mind, which tendencies, which leanings, which habits support awakening and which diminish awakening and put us back to sleep. Back into suffering. And so discernment is the most common translation of this term. The Sanskrit is dharma vichaya. And like everything in this teaching, it's about actually paying a lot more attention to our inner experience on a moment by moment, immediate basis. Not sort of some idea of how we're doing or some sense of how we're doing, but like what's happening now. And so the Sanskrit term dharma vichaya is a compound word. The first part is dharma, and this is the little d dharma that stands for experience, like sort of atoms of experience or moments, units of experience. And then the second half, vichaya, means analysis. So analysis of experience is what the word means really literally. But if we were to say analysis of experience, it sounds like kind of very like heady or something like that. Like, I'm going to figure out my experience. And it seems like the harder we try to figure out the experience, the more screwed up we get, you know. So probably that very idea of discernment as sort of figuring out something might be a little bit self-defeating. And in the traditional texts, the early texts of Buddhism, the way it's described, this dharma vichaya, this discernment, the way it's described is a kind of analysis, though. It's really paying attention to cause and effect as an analytical tool. I think when we think analysis, we think of things in fixed categories, like we're going to figure out which category is this unknown thing. How do I put it in this category or that category? It has this element, but the way they understood analysis in early Buddhism was nothing really fits in any category, but some things lead to other things, or some things are associated with or support other things happening. This arises with that, and this doesn't arise with that. So things sort of come together in constellations of causes and conditions. So they're really interested in what leads to what, you know. You know, we seem to be sort of interested in sort of some sort of rigid, fixed sort of categorization, and they were interested in how do you sort of describe the flow, and describe the flow and understand the flow. So sometimes maybe we should think of our life as a river, you know. What? Why do we throw that enormous hunk of concrete in the middle of our river, you know? Or when is the river really flowing smoothly, and what are the back eddies and so on. So anyway, what they wanted to analyze there when they were looking at this Dharma Vichaya was, what are the things that happen in the body, in the mind, when we speak, that lead to release from suffering, that lead to more joy, that lead to more kindness, that lead to awakening? And what are the things that lead to the opposite? What leads to what leads to more suffering or less suffering? Or sometimes we say, what's wholesome and what's unwholesome? And the idea is that we can't sort of intrinsically tell by looking at the qualities or the colors or the shapes or the names for things. We can only tell by looking at the results. So that's a different, we have a little different frame than that. So this is really good to think about. Looking at the results. Oh, that led to more suffering, or that led to less suffering. And remember that the first factor of awakening was mindfulness. So these two are going to work together. There's a kind of a sense of a progression here, one thing supporting the next. And so let's just remember for a second what mindfulness is. It's a word much in the air. So mindfulness is paying more attention to the particularities of present moment experience. And mindfulness practice was described by the Buddha as having four areas of focus. So it's good to keep in mind these four areas of focus and just kind of check ourselves out. Are we paying attention to all these areas? Or are we sort of off stuck in one all the time? Or none, you know? So the first area of focus is the body. The first foundation of mindfulness is the body. So asking, how does the body really feel? Where is the body? What is our attitude about the body? What is the experience of being in a body? And in that category, they include breath awareness. This incredibly helpful tool of breath awareness shows up in all practices, I think, to some extent. And then the second area of mindfulness is to look at what comes in through the senses, you know, beyond the body. What's coming in through the senses? And how are we reacting and responding in sort of a low level kind of before thought kind of way? Oh, I like that. Oh, don't, you know, pleasant and unpleasant, positive and negative, what we're attracted to, what we're repelled by. To notice that at a moment by moment basis, you know, from the senses, you know, the eyes take in some information, the ears hear something, you smell something. There's some experience, and that includes actually noticing a thought arising, but that's a more complicated story. But let's just think about the senses. And so to actually notice, what are we sensing? You know, what are we sensing? So quickly the mind generalizes and sort of flattens things out, right? A later philosophy of Buddhism called the Yogacara philosophy said that there's three problems with thinking. I was just thinking of one of them. One of the three problems with thinking is flattening, which is this incredibly useful tool we have of taking like a word or a concept to represent a vast range of experience. But the result of that useful, you know, handy tool of using concepts to sort of flatten out experiences, we miss most of experience. And an example might be a tree. The word tree, the concept tree. If you look around in your experience and look at trees, I brought this up at Sandwich where there are lots of trees this last weekend, but we can look at this. You know, this thing we call a tree, it has a million different expressions, right? One looks this way, one looks that way, one has this kind of leaves, that kind of, you know, shape. One is evergreen. You know, so trees are incredibly diverse, but we just use this one word tree to stand for this incredible diversity of experience. And so we do that with everything else too. We sort of flatten things out with our concepts, which in a way is useful and important. You know, you're asking somebody to go wait under the tree, and it's good if we all agree that's a tree. But to actually look at a tree and actually look at our experience. So you can think of the different ways that you do this flattening. So that's why it's helpful to sort of reinvigorate our attention to what's actually coming in through the senses and how does this organism, this mind-body organism, respond just instantly, you know? Probably do that with trees too. I like some trees more than other trees. And the third area of mindfulness is to actually pay attention to the thinking and emotions that sort of get elaborated out of that process. You know, I like this kind of tree, you know, it's a great tree, you know. Here, I know all about it, you know, it's deciduous, something like this. And how do we do that with everything else, including other people? Oh, I know exactly what she's like, you know. So that's a thought. I mean, some sensation happened. I looked and I saw some shape of colors and, you know, forms that I identify as Elizabeth, you know? And then thoughts arise, right? And thoughts arise. So instead of notice that process. You know, of course, it's very pleasant to look at Elizabeth. You know? In this moment, you know, these things change. You know? Another time, maybe it won't be so pleasant. Who knows, you know? Depends on what's going on with me and with Elizabeth and with the rest of the world. So to notice the thinking that arises and the feelings, the emotions that arise. And then the fourth is, how does all of this, so we see it's sort of getting more and more elaborate, right? We're such elaborate beings, right? So how does this elaboration lead to even bigger patterns, habits? I mean, how do we get into this mess, right? Right? We have habits and patterns. And so to be mindful of those. And in the Buddha's description of this fourth foundation of mindfulness, he didn't really talk about sort of psychological habits or personality. I don't know if they had that concept exactly in his time, but he actually brought up some of the lists that he has used to describe patterns and habits, like the Four Noble Truths. He brings that up, like, look at your life reflected by the Four Noble Truths. You know, what is suffering, the actual experience of suffering, you know, and so on. And then, so I mentioned this last week, a couple of the other habits he mentioned, or patterns of existence, I guess, is maybe a better word, not habits, patterns of existence, are the five hindrances and the seven factors of awakening. So there it's like the first one includes all of them. Yeah. It's kind of weird. And so all of this is kind of, in a way, an antidote to our incredibly sort of compelling sort of me-ness, right? What if we drop the idea that the organizing principle is me and look instead at experience with different sort of points of view and frames? And when we do that, what we get is a lot more information. What we get is a lot more information about what's happening beyond our opinion of what's happening or what we think is happening through our sort of flattening process, like, oh, what a terrible day, what a great day, or whatever. Like, that's a flattened day, right? You say, oh, I had a great day. That was a day that's been flattened, you know, just... Or same with a terrible day, right? And of course it wasn't just great or great day. It was a rich, you know, how many millions of moments happened, you know? So to look at flattening. But anyway, as we're becoming more aware of what's happening, you know, and returning to this moment, what's happening? Then it gives it more information, and then we can practice the second factor. See? They help each other. Of discernment. Like, now that I notice, you know, that I cognize Elizabeth and have some feeling for Elizabeth, you know, where do I go from there, you know? What's wholesome here? What's helpful, you know, to smile? yeah, but I also know. You know, or to just be like, I got stuff to do, I'm going to ignore Elizabeth, you know, which is what I usually do. Sorry. Excuse me. But it's a habit, right? So there's mindfulness, right? There's mindfulness and there's discernment. What leads to what, you know? And then so this requires some reflection too, like, huh, you know, after I left the room, how do I feel now? Ah, I just kind of blew right past Elizabeth without saying hello, you know? Ah, doesn't feel too good. So mindfulness provides the material for the second factor of discernment. And the operative idea is, where should we put our energies? And one of the ways they describe this process of discernment, and especially they also talk about this in working with the five hindrances, is we have some choices around what we give energy to and what we don't give energy to. And they talk about it in terms of starving and feeding. Starving and feeding, they use that metaphor in the early Buddhist teachings. I was going to bring an excerpt for that, but I forgot, but it's probably long enough anyway. To me next time. That we have a little bit the frame of like controlling, right? And it might be that these sort of things can't be sort of controlled in that way, but we can maybe have some influence over what we feed and what we don't feed, what we feed, what we starve. So now let's just remember what the five hindrances are. And I'm so happy I thought of a way to remember these. So hopefully this, yeah, well, yeah. Oh, you've got a mnemonic going? That's cool. Mm-hmm. But I've been thinking about them lately in terms of two pairs and doubt. Like doubt is sort of over everything, right. You know. So the two pairs, the first pair, and I changed the wording a little bit so that they would be easier to remember, but it's the same ideas. These are pretty close to the original. So the first pair is desire and aversion, grabbing onto things and pushing things away. And the second pair is dullness, you know, or sleepiness, and restlessness. So the first are sort of, you know, this powerful habit of what we want, what we don't want. And the second two are about energy. Are we kind of too dull, too sleepy, not putting enough energy in our life? Or are we too like, ah, you know, too restless, too jaggy? And then doubt, you know, doubting ourself, doubting the practice, doubting our choices. You know, like, so we're doing this discernment, right? And we're trying to make choices, right? This is actually about making choices, you know? Subtle choices, moment to moment, we're doing this discernment. I'm going to put more energy into friendliness, you know? Less energy into getting shit done, you know? Might be something that I might practice with my discernment. But then doubt arises. Like, oh, you know? I'm tired, I'm not getting enough done, you know? Maybe Elizabeth doesn't like me anyway, you know? Right? Doubt arises. Very generous of you. Let me use you as an example tonight. Thank you.
I can handle.
Yeah, I know you can. Yeah, I know you can. So doubt is there. So this discernment and the mindfulness happen in the sort of the shadow of the five hindrances, right? Or you could say they illuminate the five hindrances so that the shadows get kind of wiped out and the five hindrances lose their power. And all of early Buddhism, he talks a lot about the incredible power of just recognizing things. Incredible power of just recognizing things. Don't necessarily need to fix or improve, but just to recognize something. And so a lot of times the five hindrances are personified in this character who shows up named Mara. And I'll try to remember to bring a Mara passage next week too. And usually what happens is, like, you know, Mara's like whispering sweet nothings in the Buddha's ear about, you know, how messed up, you know, negative stuff. And the Buddha's power is he can turn towards Mara and say, oh, I see you. And then Mara just like goes, drat, you know, and stomps out because Mara's been seen. So these hindrances and these doubts operate partly because we're not really so aware of them, right? We're hearing this voice in our head, you know, I'm not a good person, I don't have enough energy, I'm never going to figure this out, my economic problems, my personal problems, my relationship problems, And so the Buddha is saying with these factors of awakening, the first two things are to notice what's happening and discern, you know, like, oh, and to see, to recognize, to see, oh, that's doubt. Now what do I do? Maybe nothing, you know? Maybe I don't need to do anything but see that. So the early commentators looking at this factor of discernment. They talked a lot about, you know, this more aware of what's happening and then discerning. Should I do this? Should I do that? You know, what leads to more joy? What leads to more suffering? But it sounds a little mechanical to us. And so what's interesting is the modern commentators that I've read or downloaded, you know, listened to, you know, zapped into my brain through the internet, they are mostly translating the second factor as interest, which is interesting, literally.
Discernment is interest.
Yeah, instead of discernment, interest. And interest in terms of getting more interested. Getting more interested, being more interested, bringing up interestedness, or maybe you could say curiosity, about experience. Like, what's really happening here, you know? So it's sort of like supporting, like they're saying, you know, really what you need to do is support mindfulness more with interest and with curiosity, and worry a little bit less about, like, you can figure something out or make, you know, all these minute choices that early Buddhism seems to be calling for. So that's interesting, and you know, and it can be sort of mundane, worldly, big picture things. It could be moment by moment things. I was listening to this talk by James Baraz, who's a Vipassana teacher. He visited here one time, actually. Right, really nice guy. Sang songs to us. Did you come?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, anyway, and this talk by James Baraz, he was telling a story about when he was in college with a friend of his. And he said he and his friend had been, like, completely sort of on the same track through high school, a friend from high school. They'd sort of gotten the same grades, taken the same classes, you know, just kind of been buddies. But when they got to college, his friend just took off, you know, and took all the advanced honors classes and got incredible grades and graduated summa cum laude, or however you pronounce that, and went on to be, like, a well-regarded professor, you know. And he said he realized this about their senior year, that something had changed, you know, and he was still a kind of a B-plus student, and, you know, kind of hanging around. And he asked his friend, well, how come you're doing so much better than me, do you think? I mean, are you actually smarter than me? And we didn't realize it at first, you know. And his friend said, well, you know what I thought of, like, as soon as when we started college, was how interesting it is that these professors would choose to devote their life to this subject, even if at first it might seem to me like a really boring, dry, uninteresting thing. And so throughout college, I've been more and more interested in that question, like, why would somebody, like, love, like, statistics or, you know, economics so much? And so I've been just, like, my whole college career just trying to figure that out, like, trying to sort of get in the headspace of the professors. And as a result, I naturally, like, you know, got interested in the material and did all the reading and, you know, got good grades. So that was an interesting example, like, just getting interested, you know, just getting interested. And that's kind of an external thing, getting interested in, you know, academic studies or something like that. But also meaning to get interested in our life, you know, like, what's really happening in my life and how interesting that is. And so meditation supports this. If we bring up this quality of curiosity and interest in meditation, that supports this also. So that's why I said those words during Zazen, like, this is kind of, in a way, an investigation or, like, sort of a, like, a questioning, like, oh, you know, what is it, you know? What is it to be really present? What is it to feel the breath and feel the body and to notice thoughts coming and going? Like, how interesting. Although, on the same token, I remember at one point Norman used to say, yeah, it's great to get more interested in the mind, but not too interested. So we don't want to get sort of too, sort of like ingrown, you know, like obsessed, you know, like, oh, wow, you know, I want a better, you know, more thoughts, cool thoughts. You know? Like, you know, it's still just thoughts, you know, it's just experience. It's just a body, you know. It's not that interesting, you know. But it is interesting, so it's interesting, you know, to walk these lines, you know. So, but it's an embodied practice, you know, so not just a way of thinking or a philosophy. And so this term insight, but I find this term, thinking about interest, as a nice bridge. Maybe we can think about interest as in between one and two, like a bridge, bridging mindfulness and discernment.
Mm-hmm.
Like, sort of being interested, what's the information from mindfulness, and how can I discern these tendencies, these leanings, these choices that are happening all the time? Can I work with them a little more skillfully? And then it goes on just immediately to the next one, which is diligence, and onto the next one after that, which is joy. That as we get interested and are able to discern a little more, if it all is working well, the way the Buddha recommended, we start, you know, we get some positive feedbacks. Loops going, right? We feel a little better. We have a little more energy. So naturally, we're a little more diligent, you know? We wake up in the morning, we're like, oh, you know, I don't totally feel like sitting, but it's so interested to go sit, you know? You know, like, oh, well, I'm going to go sit, you know? It feels good. And then joy emerges, and then the rest of the thing kind of unspools from there. So I thought I might share with you a practice that I invented for the mindfulness classes called the mindful check-in. So we have to step out for a moment from our formal Dharma talk mode and stand up. And just feel free to stretch a little bit, you know, so we're touching into the body here, embodied life. I have a theory that now that world peace might be attained if every minute in every workplace had 20 minute stretch breaks every 20 minutes. Stretch. I mean, the body is not designed to sit still this long. No, sure. So anyway, after you're a little bit, you know, I don't do a big yoga routine, but just kind of get yourself kind of back to yourself. And then really stand. So feel the weight of the feet on the floor. Feel the presence of the body. You could have the hands dangling or shashir either way. And so the mindful check-in is a deliberate sort of application of these different frames of mindfulness. You could do it in any posture, but I think standing is good because we're not used to standing still. Either we're sitting, working away, you know, collapse, lying down, or walking somewhere to get something else done. So standing is something we don't associate with all these activities. So it's sort of a freed up posture. So to really stop and stand, and then to make an inquiry in three areas. The first is, what are the sensations in the body right now? What do you notice if you just touch into the feeling in the body? This might be particular sensations. Just notice the mass sensations. Might be an overall sort of feeling, kind of feeling tone of the body. You might notice breath in this context of the body. What does it actually feel like to be breathing? And you notice when the mind wanders away, to bring it back, what are the sensations in the body right now? So that's the first one. And then, to move the focus to emotion. Now this is easier when somebody's not talking to you, but you can just learn the form and practice this during your day on your own. But just to be curious, what are the emotions or the emotion? Are there sort of nameable emotion states happening? Is there sort of a nonverbal feeling for what the emotion is right now? We don't always notice emotion except when it really flares up. But what's happening with emotion? Question for a little bit, what's happening with emotion? And then the third and the last one, which is probably the most difficult if somebody's talking to you, let's see what you can do, is thinking itself. See what you can notice about thinking. Particular dominant thoughts, patterns of thinking. So thinking sort of dull and spacey, or is it kind of jagged, or is it very rapid or elaborated? Just to check in, you know, stop during the day, check in, What's the thinking? That's the third question. What's happening in thinking? That's it, you know, you can do this in a minute or two. No one even has to know that you're doing a mindful check-in. You can do this at work, you know, at home. Walking down the street, waiting for a stop sign, you know, subway. So just sort of a stopping and checking in, but then it helps sort of bring up some questions like that, you know, like, how am I doing? I have so many habitual answers to, right? This is sort of like investigating experience with these different dimensions from the foundations of mindfulness. So thank you for trying that. And then we have information for our discernment, and one of the major things we're trying to discern that the Buddha talked a lot about is what are we adding to experience? There's experience, and then the mind has an incredible ability to add all kinds of stuff, right? Judgment, elaboration, fear. And one of the ways the Buddha taught, the Buddha had two sort of connected stories about what do we add to experience, or how do we process experience, how do we sort of discern our relation to experience. He had two related stories that both use arrows as metaphors, which many of us probably have heard before. These are very popular Buddhist stories. Sometimes they get kind of mixed together in the popular press. So we're worried about gun violence. They must have been worried about arrow violence, you know, in that day. So the first story about the arrows is the story of the second arrow, or the second dart, sometimes it's translated. And the idea of this one, and this is kind of a discernment mindfulness thing, we can become more aware of this and how we do this and not do it as much. So the idea is that something difficult is going to happen, right? That's baked into experience. There's pain and difficulty as part of experience. And that's the first arrow. An arrow hits us. A pain in the knee, a painful memory, somebody looks at us funny, you know, anything. Something painful. And we now know from the super geniuses doing all the neuroscience work that internally there's very little difference between a physical and emotional pain. It activates the same regions of the brain. Yeah. So if something happens to us, and then somehow, the minute we experience something painful, says the Buddha, we can incredibly quickly grab our own bow and arrows, turn it around, and shoot ourselves with a second arrow. So here's how the Buddha described it. The Blessed One said, when touched with a feeling of pain, the uninstructed, run-of-the-mill person sorrows, grieves, and laments, beats her breast, becomes distraught, and so she feels two pains, physical and mental, just as if they were to shoot a man with an arrow and right afterwards were to shoot him with another one, so he would feel the pain of two arrows. In the same way, when touched with a feeling of pain, the uninstructed, run-of-the-mill person, so somebody who doesn't practice this stuff, sorrows, grieves, and laments, beats his breast, becomes distraught, and so he feels two pains, physical and mental, or we could also say mental and mental. So, you know, judgment, you know, self, doubt, you know, you there's a menu, right? You know what these are. So the one of the discernment practices is to notice that happening. To notice, like, because we're a little more dropped into our present moment experience through our mindfulness practice, and we're interested in how we're responding to things and what leads to what, you know, when something happens, we can a little more often discern, oh, you know, that was really painful, you know, I really feel such and so a feeling. And I notice this desire to, like, add additional, you know, weight and blame and judgment and all that stuff, you know, all the stuff on top of it, right? And maybe, you know, discernment. I can instead notice the body. I could breathe. Instead, I could do something with attention so that I don't do that or don't do it as much. So that's the story of the two arrows. The second story is the story of the poison arrow. Story of the poison arrow. This is another way of describing our unskillful responses to difficulty. And in the second story, what happens is the metaphor is a really nasty thing happened to you. You got shot by a poison arrow. You know, something like, this is maybe a little worse than the first arrow of the two. This is like a really bad arrow, big poison arrow. It really hurts, you know, something really that you really don't like happens. And in the metaphor, your friends notice you've been shot by an arrow, a poison arrow, and they want to like pull the arrow out, you know. They want to help you, or you could say you want to help yourself. You want to kind of, you know, there's a desire on the one hand to get this arrow out, you know, to process this wound, to heal, to move on, to say ouch and just move on. But that is what the story points out is we don't always do that. We get a little bit obsessed with the arrow. Why did this happen to me? What kind of arrow is that anyway? Hey, did you shoot that arrow or did you shoot that arrow? And meanwhile, our friends are like, it's poison, you know, get it out. So here's how the Buddha, this one's really cute. The Buddha goes into lots of details to make his point. It's just as if a man was wounded by an arrow that was thickly smeared with poison. His friends and companions, kinsmen and relatives, want to provide him with a surgeon. But the man would say, I won't have this arrow removed until I know whether the man who wounded me was a noble warrior, a Brahmin, a merchant, or a worker. And he would say, I will not have this arrow removed until I know the given name and clan name of the man who wounded me, until I know whether he was tall, medium, or short, until I know whether he was dark, ruddy brown, golden colored, until I know his hometown, village, or city, until I know whether the bow with which I was wounded was a long bow or a crossbow, until I know whether the bowstring with which I was wounded was fiber, bamboo threads, sinew, hemp, or bark. This is like a 2,000-year-old joke, this passage. Until I know whether the shaft with which I was wounded was wild or cultivated. Until I know whether the feathers of the shaft with which I was wounded were made from a vulture, made from a stork, made from a hawk, made from a peacock, or some other bird. Until I know whether the shaft with which I was wounded was bound with the sinew of an ox, a water buffalo, a langur, or a monkey. He would say, I will not have this arrow removed until I know whether the shaft with which I was wounded was that of a common arrow, a curved arrow, a barbed or a calf-toothed, or an oleander arrow. This man would die. And then he concludes, this man would die. Right? So this is a process of mindfulness and discernment, right? Something happens to us. Are we willing to move on, you know? Are we willing to say, ouch, you know? Respond in some way that seems skillful and move on? Or are we obsessed with our wound, you know? Are we obsessed with the arrow? Are we working in the realms of blame and judgment and so on and so forth? Isn't that funny? So the last thing I want to say about discernment, and then we'll close, is that actually all of this work involves quite a bit of imagination. We sometimes think of these things as sort of somewhat dry processes of personality or spiritual growth, whatever we think that means. But I was thinking about this, and I think it actually is quite an imaginative act to actually think that we could have a different mind, right? I mean, we're quite habituated to our mind the way it is, so it's an act of imagination to think, wow, there could be less suffering. There could be more joy. There could be the possibility of being hit by an arrow and just like pulling it out, like, oh, ouch, okay. That was an arrow. So this requires some imagination. It's a kind of a deep reframing of experience itself, that we, not only do we think we know who we are, we think we know what reality is. So this is a sort of imaginary act to wonder, like, is reality really the way I think it is? Might it be some other way that doesn't lead to so much suffering? And so there's kind of a two levels of work here with our habitual view. On the one hand, imagining a better way of being and experiencing experience in a sort of fresh way. So we're sort of working with experience very directly, and we're bringing emotion and curiosity sort of into the mix. Like, huh, you know, I think I know that that's, you know, a feeling of such and so, but, you know, what is it really? So that's what I wanted to say about discernment. So it's interesting, isn't it, the way they kind of support each other. Last week I suggested, I don't know if you remember this, but last week I suggested that we really start to work with the five hindrances. And so this is a good thing to continue working with, I think, this next week if you want some homework, to see which are the hindrances that are most important for you at this point, you know. You know, is it desire, wanting things to be different, aversion, not wanting that? You know, is it, you know, dullness? Is it sort of jagginess and restlessness? Or is it just doubt, you know? And to see if when we cognize these hindrances emerging, if we can then, maybe with some vehicle like that mindful check-in or with zazen or just with just paying attention, we can then sort of bring mindfulness like online, you know, like, oh, you know, I feel so tired and dull, I don't want to do anything. And instead of just being like, oh, what a lazy munkin I am, you know, to be like, oh, well, what's the feeling in the body right now, you know? What's the emotion? What's the thinking? And to see if we can kind of meet the hindrances with mindfulness and just see what happens, you know? You know, we don't expect the arrows are all going to fly out, you know, but it might change the feeling, you know, this wounded feeling, to kind of meet hindrance and difficulty with mindfulness. And then we can start to also discern, like, well, then what, you know? And just this very practice I'm suggesting is a kind of a discernment, right? Like, wow, you know, I discern that this feeling of heaviness or depression or restlessness or whatever it is could be met with mindfulness, you know? And then we'll see what happens, you know? Maybe I'll feel a little differently. So here's my kind of final summary of all this. Maybe discernment is get interested in experience and see what happens. Get interested in experience and see what happens. So maybe not so much thinking we can sort of control all this, but just get interested in experience and see what happens. So pausing helps, regular meditation helps. You know, just learning these words, if we can learn them in a way that supports practice, helps. And just trusting, you know. Trusting the unfolding of our life is probably the most important thing. Somehow.